Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Mind's Veils by Eric Weinberg. According to the Dharma, we all have Buddha nature, minds that are clear, open, and limitless. So why do we find it so difficult to see these qualities in ourselves? In this teaching from the fourth chapter of the book Luminous Mind by the First Kala Rinpoche, we look at the mental habits that keep us from seeing our minds as they really are. We will examine the four veils that obscure the mind, as well as methods that can clear away those obstacles and reveal our true nature. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So, I think, have I arrived at the right place? This is the Dharma Talk for Sunday, right? All right. It's been, you know, I really was expecting to be doing something else the last 20 minutes, but hey, that's life, right? So, originally I was going to give a talk that Lama Kathy decided she thought would be better if we saved for some things we're planning in the future. And when we were talking about what might be a good topic, we chose a chapter from a book that's, I think I've got here. It's a wonderful book if you want some great Dharma teachings that you can take in bite-sized pieces, like a chapter at a time, and contemplate over a long period. The book's called Luminous Mind, and the teacher is the first Kalu Rinpoche, who was just an extraordinary being. So this is the fourth chapter. It's we're going to be talking about a chapter called Mind's Veils. So the way that we think about this is that everybody, you know, we make a couple assumptions, right, in Buddhism, really only two. I like to say that we have two things we believe, as opposed to most spiritual traditions that have a lot of things to believe in. The two things we believe in simply are that every sentient being has the nature of awakening or Buddha nature, complete with all its qualities and power and everything that Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, demonstrated. Well, we have that in us already. So if you're looking for it, the first advice is call off the search. The search itself is a distraction or an obstacle, because it's there. What Buddha Dharma is all about, what the Buddha taught, is how to uncover that nature. So that's the first belief, that we all have that nature, and we have the tools to uncover that nature in ourselves. The second thing we believe is that everything is interdependent. Everything's connected. That's important because, and this is where the mind's veils come in, we mostly don't see that. Mostly we live in what you read in spiritual teachings as dualism. In other words, there's me here, there's you there, we're separate. You know, I have my experience, you have your experience, and so on. And it's so limiting that this expansive experience, this expansive energy of the way things actually are, can't dawn because we're so busy doing what the Buddha called craving and clinging. Craving meaning that we want what we want, and when we try hard to get it, so we'll be happy. That's craving. So we have what we like, and then we have what we don't like. So craving is also craving the ability or the resources to get away from stuff that we find that is unpleasant. One of the odd things is, one of the very odd things is that what I think of as pleasant might mean nothing to you. And what you think of as pleasant might mean nothing to me. And same goes with what I try to avoid, you might relish, and what you might try to avoid, I might relish. In other words, there's the things that we ascribe absolute reality to actually don't have any reality like that at all. All right. So that's the way a mind's veils work. Is like, we're working with what we think of as our direct experience, and we think of as reality, and it turns out if we're seeing anything at all, it's very, very obscured. It's been very clouded over. So that's craving. Clinging follows along with craving. It's like, we know it's not quite right inside, you know, even when we get what we want. Very oftentimes, we don't even get a rush of this happiness that we desire. And if we do get that rush of happiness, it doesn't last long. And we have to go through the whole drill again. And so because our efforts, in a sense, for happiness are ineffective, we tell ourselves stories about it. So it's because of this and because of that. And it was because she said this or he said that, and I reacted this way and that way, or I have to have this thing because, and we have this long narrative. That's clinging. So what the Buddha taught was that, okay, this clouds over your Buddha nature. This is a veil for the mind. And he taught a path of meditation, meditation is just working with the mind, so that slowly and gradually and directly we can begin to wear these veils thin and uncover this extraordinarily open, limitless, luminous nature that's already in us. So that's sort of by way of introduction. This chapter is not long, and actually it is so rich that I'm going to rely on it for a lot of this talk directly. And then where things seem a little bit like I have something I could add in order to open things up more, I'll do that. And of course, at the end, if you have any comments or questions, we'll leave room for that, because I think that's really, really important. As always, because we're studying the precious Dharma, which is truly precious, precious in our lives, a jewel in our lives, let's bring our minds right here to be with the Dharma by chanting the refuge prayer. I'll chant it 3 times in Tibetan. If you know it, please chant along with me, but with your microphone muted, because the timing over the internet is cacophonous if you try to sing together. And if you don't know it, just follow along in your heart, wishing to open and take refuge in your highest, best self, in your Buddha nature. and to take refuge in the teachings that guide you to that nature, and take refuge among the people who are walking that path with you. Sanjay Chudong Soki Chudnam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin So Ki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchir Sanjay Drupar Sho Sanjay Chudong Soki Choknam La Changchu Pardu Dakni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin So Ki Pe Sunam Ki Rola Penshir Sanjay Drupar Sho Sanjay Chudong Soki Choknam La Changchu Pardu Dakni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin So Gi Pe Sunam Ki Rola Penshir Sanjay Drupar Sho. Thank you. So, Mind's Veils. Actually, Kala Rinpoche himself starts out by quoting somebody else. He quotes the third Karmapa. The third Karmapa wrote something called The Aspiration of Mahamudra, which is a beautiful thing that could be your companion your whole life, and you would never exhaust the depth of it. So here's the section that Kala Rinpoche started his talk with. Self-manifestation, which has never existed as such, is erroneously seen as an object. Through ignorance of self-awareness, is mistakenly experienced as an I. Through attachment to this duality, we are caught in the conditioned world. May the root of confusion be found. So he begins, if there's no difference between the mind of a Buddha and our own mind, why does a Buddha have so many qualities and we do not? The difference is that in our minds, the Buddha nature is obscured by all sorts of coverings. Each of the three facets of pure mind discussed in the last chapter, and those facets are this, limitless openness. In other words, your experience having no center and no boundary. Luminosity or clarity, which is actually being able to feel the uniqueness with everything you have an interdependent connection with. So the ability to see and discern is a quality of the mind. And then the third one is the ability to know itself. In other words, we can look at the mind and realize what it is, what it actually is. And most of the time, we look at our mind and we just get our list of preferences and personality traits, and this is who I am. But there's something else there that's actually a unique expression of this awakened nature. And that's what we're being invited to uncover. So each of these three facets of pure mind becomes at the impure level. In other words, seeing everything dualistically and having what's really there corrupted by your what you like and what you don't like and what you don't care about. So each of these three facets themselves at the impure level, which we call in Buddhism ignorance, one of the elements that constitute dualistic experience becomes manifest. And that ignorance is an ignorance of this limitless openness of mind that leads to, because we don't get the limitless openness part, we posit, or it leads to a conception of a subject, me, or the observer. And that ignorance of essential clarity leads to ignorance of exterior objects. You can see how this happens. Everything, not only is our Buddha nature covered with this conception of that there's an I here, that there's an experiencer here that's separate from what is experienced. So just that kind of automatically gives us the causes and conditions for being ignorant of what's right in front of us, because we cover that over with what we like, what we don't like, what we don't care about. And this is how the subject, object, me, other dichotomy arises. Once the two poles, so that's step one. We just lose this basic, very basic openness. And we leap into, I experience and this is what I experience. So once we do that, once those two poles of dualistic view have been established, various relationships develop among them, which in turn motivate different activities. The stages of this process comprise the four veils that mask the pure mind or Buddha nature. The four veils are the veil of ignorance, the veil of basic propensity. We will describe what that is. The veil of mental afflictions, we all know what that is. And the veil of karma, which it's more than what you think. So we'll discuss that too. They are consecutive and structured one after another. So, you know, dealing directly through meditation with dropping a thought, dropping a feeling, and returning to an object and letting your mind rest until it can rest on no object at all and rest on itself. Obviously, is developing the strength and the ability to experience this limitless openness directly, which is a way of saying taking off that veil of ignorance. So he goes on and says, the simple fact that mind doesn't recognize what it truly is called fundamental ignorance. It's the basic inability of the conditioned mind to perceive itself. we can compare the pure mind having the three essential qualities to calm, transparent waters in which everything can be seen clearly. The veil of ignorance is a lack of intelligence, a kind of clouded state. As an opaque vase causes water to lose its transparent clarity. In other words, the water inside is always clear, but we stick it in a vase that is solid, and its clarity, in a sense, disappears, at least to us. We can't see it. Such an obscured mind loses the experience of lucid openness and becomes ignorant of its essential nature. He says ignorance is said to be innate. In other words, we're born with this. How's it we're born with it? Well, pretty much everything, everything that you think life is comes through your senses, the five physical senses, and your mental consciousness, right? And what we're talking about here is at a deeper level than that. As Gyaltsu Rinpoche says, you want power? How ridiculous. Where's the power of the king that died 100 years ago? According to the teachings, you know, this life energy never, ever was created and never disappears, kind of like what Einstein said about energy. And, you know, can neither be created nor destroyed, and yet here it is. We're using it to communicate on the internet, right? It's amazing. It passes beyond what we normally consider as our thinking mind. So the same thing with these things that we build our lives around based on the way our senses work and the consciousness of those senses are. What happens when our body goes away? And it will go away. That is the one thing for sure. All of that dissolves into what? I mean, I think into nothing. And what remains is this basic openness that was there all the time. And what the Buddha showed is that we can experience that basic openness now. And it's what we call enlightenment. So Kala Rinpoche says we're born with it. And what he's saying is we're born with this dichotomy of experience and experiencer without understanding the that those two things aren't disconnected. They actually are the same ocean. It's just that sometimes waves rise up and we think of the waves as separate, maybe as a certain kind of wave as who we are. But the waves, just like waves in the ocean, fall back into the face of their own essence. And this path is to say, I can let go of the identification with the waves, with the way my thoughts arise and fall and what I like and don't like, and come to rest and have a sense of authentic well-being by actually recognizing, actually directly seeing my own essence. So that's the way this is working. So duality is this duality of experience and experiencer is basic ignorance, which is the root of all suffering, literally. So the veil of basic propensity, the second veil, He says, mind, controlled by ignorance, engages in delusions. That's the clinging part, the narrative we tell ourselves about stuff. Among which, the most basic root of all others is dualistic grasping in terms of subject and object. When the mind does not know the extent of its openness, instead of experiencing without center or periphery, we perceive everything through one central point of reference. This point, the center, that appropriates all experience is the observer. We call that the ego. It is in this way that mind, ignorant of its openness, engenders a delusional experience of me and I. At the end of the day, literally every day, if you reflect upon your day, it's all going to be about, it's going to be like a library of books, all with the title of me, this happened to me, or I did that, or I experienced this, or this didn't happen to me, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, we'll natter on, it was because of this, and I'll change that, and all that kind of thing. This is the veil of basic propensity. When the nature of clarity goes unrecognized, we experience a sense of other instead of the mind self-aware quality. Thus, the ego distinguishes things which become exterior objects. The appearances of the outside world and mental phenomena. This propensity of mind to be ignorant of its own nature and to perceive all situations in a dichotomous way is the veil of basic propensity and can also be called the veil of dualistic grasping. This is kind of interesting because grasping and clinging are what the Buddha taught in the second noble truth and the third noble truth as being the source and the cause of suffering. So these practices that we have to actually retrain our minds, literally develop different mental muscles and different relationships with everything that occurs to and within the mind, these practices are extremely valuable. Because actually I can say this and you can read it in the book, but if it's not the way your experience is, it's not going to help you much. It won't lessen your suffering much. However, if you begin to experience your connection with things, and when you realize you're a part of everything and everything's a part of you and your compassion arises, I mean, how could it not if we're all connected? This is the first step in a life that unfolds into joy. It's not reading another book. It's developing this mind muscle that's strong enough to cut through these veils and enter the door of what is already there, your basic awakened nature. So the veil of basic propensity, this dualistic grasping, is followed by the veil of passions. It stands to reason. The mind, ignorant of its openness and clarity, is immersed in duality. then ignorance of mind sensitivity gives rise to all the relationships that exist between the two poles, subject and object. At the pure level, sensitivity is the immediacy and multiplicity of enlightened qualities, because your relationship is an enlightened relationship and you're related to everything, okay? But in ignorance, those qualities are replaced by an endless dual relational possibility. In ignorance, we start by taking external objects to be real things. Our experience of external objects is real, and those experiences contain all our likes and all our dislikes and all our bewilderment and every other thing like that, all our craving and clinging. So yeah, there's experience, but is it pure? Are you experiencing directly? And the answer is decidedly not. It's all conditioned by the way you relate to things, right? So what we do when we do that is we ascribe some reality to things that isn't really there. We're not really experiencing somebody or something directly. So when we then experience attraction to pleasant objects or aversion to disagreeable objects and indifference to objects that seem neutral, if an object is pleasing, we want to own it or possess it. On the other hand, faced with unpleasant objects or situations, we have an attitude of rejection or avoidance. Finally, we do not relate at all with certain objects or situations because of indifference or mental dullness. These three types of relationships, attraction, aversion, and indifference, correspond to desire, hatred, and ignorance. These are the three primary mental poisons, the three main mental afflictions that animate and condition habitual mind. So you can see how what he's doing, he's showing you how these veils got built and how reaction to the previous veil creates a new and thicker veil in successive stages. On the basis of these three types of poison relationships, numerous other mental or emotional afflictions multiply, notably pride, greed, and jealousy. Pride arises from this I, which is born out of ignorance. Greed is an extension of desirous attachment, while jealousy proceeds from hatred and aversion. Thus, the three primary poisons branch into the six passions: hatred, greed, ignorance, desirous attachment, jealousy, and pride. And these in turn correspond to the six states of consciousness, characteristic of the six realms of existence. Next, these are subdivided again and again, adding up to 84,000 different types of passions. All these dualistic and afflicted relationships make up the veil of passions. So these six basic mental states are pretty good to study and contemplate and reflect on at the end of your day to see, because you can see what arises in you, and it gives you an absolute direct clue of what you're working with because of what's in this teaching. And that can make your spiritual practice, your Dharma path, much more effective. You can really kind of see things. Now, the six realms, I'm not going to go into right now, but if you ever look at a Tibetan painting that's called the Wheel of Life, you'll see that it's divided into six sections. And basically, those six sections are six realms of experience and how experience is related to. That's also something good to learn and reflect on. As far as the 84,000 different types of passions, it's interesting because in early teachings, it said that the Buddha taught 84,000 different types of meditation. So one might think that he probably was able to create some kind of meditation to help people cut through any passion that they were experiencing. So the last veil is the veil of karma. The various passions lead to a large variety of dualistic actions. You can see how this goes. We know we create karma itself means action, and we create karma by what we do, what we think, and what we say. So positive, negative, or neutral, those karmas condition our mind and cause it to take birth in one of the six realms of conditioned existence, or the six different ways of experiencing, you know, that's what that is. And you can see how this works. You know, when somebody who's always angry in this life encounters even a pleasant situation, they will find fault. They will be angry about something. When somebody who's always complains, you know, encounters something that's good, they're going to find the needle in the haystack of something that they don't like. And it conditions all of experience. It absolutely covers over, of course, openness and clarity and ability to recognize itself. The problem, if it's a problem, is all out there. And as we condition our minds more and more this way by indulging our karmic choices rather than recognizing them and transforming them, you know, we're just digging ourselves a hole deeper. As the famous philosopher Will Rogers says, when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. And that's what's being encouraged here is, okay, we got to stop digging. How do we do that? So Kalu Rinpoche closes the chapter with Dharma. That's how we do it. He calls it a practice of unveiling. He says, these four veils that cloak the mind make us ordinary beings, tossed around by delusions in the six realms of samsara. We cannot free ourselves from this condition except by eliminating the veils and unveiling the mind. The practice of Dharma offers numerous methods that allow these impurities to fall away bit by bit, thereby revealing the jewel of our pure mind. He gives a couple of images for this. One of the one I liked the best, at least yesterday when I was reading this again. He said that veils can be compared to layers of clouds covering the sky of the mind. Just as the clouds obscure the sky, the veils mask the open space as well as the clarity of its lucidity. Dharma practice, and primarily meditation, gradually removes these different veils from the grossest to the most subtle. When all these veils or coverings have been removed, there is a complete unveiling, a state of purification called Sang, S-A-N-G, in Tibetan. The complete purification is Sang. The blossoming of all the aspects of space and light that such purification reveals is described by the term Gye, G-Y-E. These two syllables, Sang Gye, which literally means perfect purity and blossoming, or completely pure and totally blossomed, together form the Tibetan word Sangye for Buddha. The state of the Buddha is the manifestation of qualities inherent to the mind once it's been purified of the veils that obscure it. This unveiling that reveals the mind's inherent pure qualities make all progress on the path of Dharma practice. So that's how he ended the chapter, was that simply Sangye, complete purification, clearing the clouds and blossoming. Blossoming is opening and opening and opening. It's limitless opening. So there's this fundamental thing that keeps us going because it's a long road. And that is this wish to grow, this wish to blossom. And along the way, we get teachings like this that encourage us and make sure that we don't go off the rails too far, which can be a problem in itself. So we have each other, and we have good Dharma teachers that we can check things out, you know, and make this the most fruitful purification and blossoming process that we could possibly have in this life. One of those great teachers, this is what I want to close with, Dilgo Chense Rinpoche. He said a lot of things, but I have a quote here from him about this path and about meditation. He said, "When about to settle in the natural way of mind essence, some people merely try to stay conscious and aware. Then they rest in this state of mental consciousness with the feeling, ah, how clear. Other people fixate on a state of utter void, as if their mind had gone blank. Both of these cases, however, are simply aspects of consciousness clinging to a dualistic experience. Whenever this duality occurs, between the clarity and the one perceiving the clarity, the emptiness and the one perceiving the emptiness, look into the nature of this stream of rigidly fixated mindfulness. By doing so, you pull up the stake to which the dualistic mind, which holds to a perceiver and something perceived is tethered, and make room for the naked, wide open, natural state of awareness, a luminous emptiness without center or edge. To apprehend in a non-dual way this luminous, open, natural state is the essence of awareness. It is the dawn of naked wisdom free from the veils of fixated experience. So that's where I would like to end. I think that's, yeah, it's pretty densely packed. I just want to amplify the one piece of last advice that Dilgo Chenzi Rinpoche shared with us, which is, so when you're meditating and you've let go of thoughts and warmth and compassion arises in your heart and you're getting some spaciousness and some clarity in that way, rather than thinking, ah, that's it, that's the end, realize that there's still experience and experiencer. And rather than just lay in the hammock and swing with that particular experience, look at the experiencer directly. Ask yourself, who is experiencing? And then rest. I believe if you're able to do that, you'll have your own direct experience of this openness, this purity, unclouded purity, and this blossoming, this just opening out and out and out, the interdependence, the connection with everything. So anyway, with that, I'd like to end the talk. We do have time left for questions or comments if anybody has any. So if you do have questions or comments, just unmute yourself and fire away.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Thank you. I tuned in late, so what book are you working with?
Oh, that was Luminous Mind by Kalu Rinpoche.
Thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome. Happy to have you on board. If there are no questions.
Eric, it's Lamo. How are you?
Hi, friend. I'm fine. How are you?
Wait for a minute. Fine. Thank you so much for this beautiful talk. I just wanted to ask a little bit about, I think sometimes we try too hard to have these experiences, and I thought maybe you could address that. What do you do when you want it, but you know that you can't be too tight about it?
Right. Well, I'll tell you what I do. When I recognize it, okay? Part of the ignorance part of this, and we're all benighted with ignorance. That's part of the game, right? But once you do catch a glimpse and you realize, man, I'm really trying hard. Sometimes people don't even recognize it until they get a headache or something like that, or muscles go into spasm. I mean, your body will eventually tell you that you're too tight too. Or if you're a little more sensitive, you might recognize, man, I'm really focused in on this. What I do is I laugh at myself because the very first part of the talk is about, oh, there is covering, right? And then the very second veil is this clinging and craving thing. This is me craving and clinging the thing that would free me from craving and clinging. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
So my tendency is to laugh. First, I think it's funny when I recognize it. Sometimes you can't recognize it, though, and that's why we can help each other on the path. It's good to have a teacher. It's good to have Dharma friends. And it's good to talk about your practice.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, I think a lot of us don't do that. We have some kind of very Western, very American notion that we don't talk about religion and politics and all that. So we don't talk about our practice. We think of it as private. Guess what? That's that dualism thing right there again. Yeah. Right there. I mean, it's us acting out the very thing that's causing us suffering. It's crazy. So first I laugh. Second, I really do try to talk to people that I trust and that I have some kind of connection with in meditation. And then third of all, if I do recognize it in the midst of practice, after at least getting a chuckle, I try to look at the one who wants it so bad.
I like that.
Rather than just want it so bad and get caught in that narrative, which is literally the definition of clinging. All our narratives are our clinging. So rather than staying stuck in the narrative of, oh, I want it so bad, look at the one that wants it so bad. Just ask, inquire, who is it that wants it this bad? Who wants it this bad? And then look and rest. And generally, for me at least, and for others that I know, this causes the mind to stop. That it kind of cuts right through that clinging, cuts right through that narrative, and something does open and some rest does happen, and I can continue on with a, let's say, a lighter touch. You know, I think it's also important to continue on if you have a practice and you notice that once you make that inquiry and you catch that rest, well, we have minds and our minds are active and thoughts will start again. So at that point, you can continue on with your practice and work further with the transformation of your thoughts and your karmas and your propensities, your habits. And that's the object of the exercise. So the whole thing, at the point of recognizing that you have a problem, actually becomes a virtuous and powerful circle.
Yeah.
It's kind of beautiful that way.
Minjin Rinpoche is wonderful for pointing that out.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it's good thing. It's a good thing to have these problems.
Exactly. It's like, otherwise we wouldn't know. I mean, these veils, the thing about these veils is we really don't see them, you know. We think they're reality. We think they're me. And when a problem comes up, that's actually a chance to realize that there's a crack in that view, and you can work with it. I can't tell you how many times bad things happen and I get angry. And on one of my practices is on one level, is to recognize that I can feel this strong emotion that I didn't know I could feel. I thought I was past it. And so there it comes, and I realize, who is it that feels angry? And we can work with that and really actually transform some karma or some veil that's actually there, you know, rather than just my fantasy about, you know, what I'm doing and how successful I am at it, whatever that is. These problem things we identify as problems are tremendous allies if we treat them that way, you know, as opposed to incorporating them into part of our narrative.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
I have a question.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. So I have been kind of using indifference to tamp down anger, but it kind of looks like that's one of the big three, indifference, is something not to use.
Well, right. It's certainly a mental poison. I mean, it's so you get angry because either because you don't get what you want or you get what you don't want, right? And it's this big reaction to those conditions. And yeah, there are things, you know, in experience that are difficult. But anger doesn't have to be the only response. It's just the strongest muscle in our brain for responding to those things. You know, does that make sense?
Well, I'm trying to like unhitch from things.
Right.
Same thing as is that indifference?
Oh, indifference really means not caring about something. Anger, you don't want to be indifferent to your anger, I don't think. I think it's very powerful, strong mental energy. Mm-hmm. It's just in the wrong relationship, or not, I shouldn't say wrong, it's just in a harmful relationship. And harming never brings about well-being, right?
Right.
But when you have strong mental energy, if you just tamp it down, you're actually doing something that, in my mind, I don't know if this is correct or not. Lamo might know. But it's like taking this strong energy that could actually cause flourishing and blossoming if it was directed differently, and tamping it down.
Okay.
Does this make sense? That's why when we teach compassion meditation, Tonglen, for instance, and we recognize that, okay, I've got this big surge of energy. My mind is plastered on top of it, this, what we call anger, right? Hatred, mm-hmm. You know? And there are basically three methods of dealing with afflictive emotions. The first one is if you're in a state or a space where you have enough mental sensitivity and acuity to look directly at it, just like it was a cloud in the sky, it'll pass just like a cloud in the sky, and you let it go. You don't tell yourself stories about it. You don't justify it. You don't get into it. It's just, oh, the cloud looked like that today. That was not the most handsome cloud, but it's gone, you know? So there's that first thing, is to be able to look directly at it. A lot of people, for a lot of us, that's hard to do, to really do it authentically, to look at it, watch it dissolve, all right? Theoretically, it's the best way. But because we have so many attachments, so many propensities, not so easy. So the second method is compassion meditation. And you're just like, I'm so angry. I can barely contain myself. And then just take a moment and recognize your interdependence, that you're connected to me and to everybody else here. And in fact, to every living thing in the universe, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And make the aspiration, may my anger, or if it's fear, it could be fear, you know, greed, jealousy, hatred, desirous, passion, whatever. May my anger contain all the anger of all beings in this very moment. May they be free of it. And may we all someday be free of it. And you take it in, just like you're doing compassion meditation, recognizing that this aspiration came from that enlightened nature that is luminous in your heart, right? Mm-hmm. Where else would an aspiration like that come from? So that light in your heart is still functional even when you're angry. And when darkness comes into light, what happens to it? It vanishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you do the second half, is that you make this strong wish that everybody could be free of anger and experience authentic well-being. So that's the second method. That's like a modification of the compassion meditation we do on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. And then the third, sometimes you're just, your buttons have been so thoroughly pushed that, you know, your mind just isn't sensitive enough or facile enough, you know, flexible enough to even do something like compassion meditation and drop it. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then, according to Shanti Deva, the best advice is lay like a log. And, you know, you think about a log just laying there on the forest floor. They're big, they're heavy, they don't move. So let it be there. And like a log, by the way, logs laying on the forest floor decay, right? They transform. They become the soil for flowers and all kinds of plants in the future. So even that, if you don't react to it, you're at least breaking part of that relationship you normally have to your anger. And ultimately, that'll be a benefit.
Okay.
That will cause some flourishing.
Thank you. Got it.
You're welcome. Well, I think I've talked 5 minutes past the finishing of this thing. So let's take a moment and dedicate the merit. I'm going to say a very brief, what's called a seven branch prayer, as a dedication of merit. And please just follow along in your heart. Whatever merit I've gathered through prostrations, offerings, confession, rejoicing, requesting, praying, and hearing the teachings of the Dharma, for the sake of the enlightenment of all sentient beings, all of this I dedicate. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.